Last September, we spoke to filmmaker Joe Berlinger about his documentary Crude, The Real Price of Oil. It's about a nearly two-decade-long legal battle between indigenous Ecuadorians and Chevron Oil over contamination of the Amazon. The film won critical acclaim, but its story didn't just end with its theatrical release. Earlier this month, a New York judge granted Chevron's request to subpoena over 600 hours of outtake footage from the film. The decision has outraged a number of documentary filmmakers and has been perceived by some as an attack on independent journalism. I'm pleased to welcome Mr. Berlinger back to our show today for an update on the ruling and the current situation in Ecuador. Hello.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We'll get into the recent ruling by Judge Lewis Kaplan in federal district court in a minute, but I want to talk about some of the issues surrounding oil contamination in Ecuador first. I suspect most of our listeners aren't familiar with this story. How did Texaco become involved in Ecuador, and how extensive were its operations there?
Well, Texaco discovered oil in the Amazon in the late 60s, and they got a concession from the government. This was in the Oriente region of the Amazon rainforest, where actually the headwaters of the Amazon River begin in Ecuador. Most of the Amazon, of course, is in Brazil. And they were given kind of carte blanche by the government to go in the lands of these indigenous tribes where people have lived in harmony with nature for millennia to drill for oil. And they spent from the late 60s until 92 when their concession ended drilling for oil. And this lawsuit is about the methodology. And what the plaintiffs allege is that for 30 years they dug massive pits of oil-contaminated waste to stick the materials there that leached into the waterways, and that also they, when you drill for oil, oil, when it comes up from the ground, it's mixed with what's called formation water. And so that is separated at the site. The raw crude is sent by pipeline to market, and the formation water, this toxic water that is highly salty and has other harmful ingredients in it, was literally pumped into the rivers and streams that feed the Amazon River and is the home to these indigenous tribes.
It's the source of all of their water.
These are water-based people, until the oil companies came, completely cut off from civilization. They use this water for drinking, for bathing, for their waterways. I wasn't sure I even wanted to make a film, but when I went down there, I was encouraged to go visit the region, and on my, first or second trip down there, we pulled up by canoe to one of the Kofan villages. Kofan are one of the tribes that are most affected. And I got out of my canoe and I noticed people were eating canned tuna fish because all the fish in the river were dead. And, that just spoke deeply to me.
Well, this has been called the Amazon Chernobyl. How large an area is affected?
Well, this is a 1,700 square mile area, probably the size of Rhode Island. And I just saw utter despair and devastation. The plaintiffs allege that there are, skyrocketing rates of cancer. Chevron claims the exact opposite. We should explain that when Chevron bought Texaco, they also inherited this lawsuit, which was originally filed in 93 in a U.S. court. It was then contested, and basically Texaco and then Chevron contested the venue, and they convinced a court here in the United States that the case should be tried in Ecuador, and it took years for that to happen. So. Finally, the case got off the ground in 2003, 2004 in Ecuador.
Now, why would they prefer to have it in Ecuador, the country where all of the contamination has occurred?
Well, ironically, they said at the time that, the Ecuadorian courts are transparent, they're fair, and that is the place that, the damage is taking place. I say ironically because now that the court now that the trial is not going well for the plaintiff, for Chevron rather, Chevron is claiming that the court system is flawed and politicized.
What are the specific allegations against Texaco? Aren't there also questions about how thorough their cleanup of certain sites was?
Most of the lawsuit is about the actual operation. They created a system that was inherently designed to pollute.
Because it was cheaper?
The plaintiffs alleged to save a few dollars on a barrel of oil. They literally pumped toxic waste into these rivers and streams. So that's part of the lawsuit. But another part of it is that when this lawsuit was originally filed in New York and then there was a fight to send it to Ecuador, Chevron, well, Texaco at the time, then Chevron, did some remediation, and the plaintiffs allege that the remediation is fraudulent, that it only covers a portion of these pits, and that some of it was just bulldozed over.
We talked earlier about the oil spill in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, that occurred when Standard Oil was still in existence, but it's now the responsibility of ExxonMobil. Is there a similar question of just who's responsible in this case?
Well, that is, you know, I think Crude is a very fair film that covers both sides of the issue. You know, the Chevron's...
They claim not.
Well, actually, they claim, you know, yes, that's true. They anything that doesn't conform to their marketing plan is considered propaganda. In fact, in their court papers that we'll get to in a minute, I was painted as a propagandist, and Crude is a creative work of fiction, and yet they find the footage so relevant that they want to get their hands on it. It's kind of funny to think that cinema verite footage of an ongoing trial is somehow creative fiction, but I guess we'll get into that in a second. But, you know, Chevron's biggest argument is that they turned this operation over to the state-run oil company, Petroecuador, and that when you see oil down there, it's fresh oil, and that it's the fault of Petroecuador. And that sounds good, you know. It sounds very compelling. But what they don't tell you is that this lawsuit was filed in 93, right after they left the country, when the country was an utter mess. And indeed, when they turned this system of production over to Petroecuador, Petroecuador was a horrible polluter, and they continued to make a mess. But the lawsuit has to do with the actions of Texaco from 67 to 92. And more importantly, it's about the infrastructure itself. The oil production methodology was one that would never be used in this country. It was a system inherently designed to dump waste into drinking water. And so the theory of the lawsuit is that even if Petroecuador continued to pollute, it is the people who designed and created a faulty system that should be responsible.
How much money in damages are the plaintiffs seeking, and how do you compensate indigenous people for things that can't be recovered, like certain cultural things, land things?
There's an independent expert that was assigned by the court to look into this, and he has recommended that the price tag for the cleanup is $27 billion, which also includes money for excess cancer deaths, for the restoration of some aspects of the indigenous culture. To me, the great tragedy is that, you know, the place could get cleaned up a little bit. I think it's really been devastated. But the impact on indigenous culture, I think, is irreparable. And I think that's, you know, again, I think the film takes a very neutral position on the merits of the lawsuit itself. The reason I made this film is that I was heartbroken to see the impact on these indigenous people. And for me, what multinational companies have done in the extractive industries in the 21st century is just the same old horrible mistreatment of indigenous people that started with the Spanish conquistadors and continued through our own creation of this country, what we did to our indigenous people, and now it's happening all over again in the form of multinational abuse of indigenous lands.
We're talking with Joe Berlinger about what has happened since the release of his film Crude, The Real Price of Oil. On today's Underreported, 2 weeks ago, Judge Lewis Kaplan granted Chevron's request to look at 600 hours of outtakes. How did you get dragged into this, and how did part of the case wind up back in the United States courts if they fought so hard to get him into Ecuador?
That's something my lawyers can better explain. I still don't understand how in a foreign proceeding a corporation, a private litigant in a pollution case in Ecuador can get their hands on a filmmaker's footage. I still don't understand that. I was stunned. I was actually on another shoot. I was having a lovely shoot in the Bahamas with Lenny Kravitz, not thinking about this case at all. And my wife called me up and said, "You're not going to believe this, but we've just got, you know, literally a stack of 12 inches of paper from Chevron that must have cost, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of the best lawyering that you can find, compelling me to turn over all of my footage." And I got to tell you, you know, for me to, you know, now it's, you know, my film is a David and Goliath story of indigenous people fighting a big oil company, and now I've been dragged into yet another David and Goliath story.
Well, why did they say they want to look at all this extra footage?
Well, you know,
what do they think is in it?
Well, they are looking to scour my dailies in the hopes of finding inappropriate behavior on the part of the plaintiffs to use in their case. And they point to a handful of scenes in the film that show, in their minds, questionable behavior, and therefore there must be some big smoking gun in my footage. For me, you know, it has nothing to do with what the content of the footage is. This is a blatant steamrolling over my First Amendment rights, and I would be equally resistive to the plaintiffs, who I am sympathetic to in terms of the underlying plaintiffs, the indigenous people. Obviously, there's no disguising that I am sympathetic to their plight. It doesn't mean I have taken a position in the actual lawsuit, but I would be equally resistive if the plaintiffs were compelling me to turn over my footage.
And, but why? What's the difference if it doesn't really prove anybody's point?
You know,
is this like a reporter with notes?
Exactly.
Except that they're claiming you're not the same as a journalist.
Well, luckily, the one victory we've had in Judge Kaplan's court is that he has affirmed that Crude is a work of journalism and that I should be protected by the journalist's privilege. However, Kaplan argued that they pierced that journalist privilege, which I find extraordinary. Just to answer your first question, the harm in turning over my dailies is that a film, any film like this, is based on trust. It is based on, I've gotten some incredible, unprecedented access. I have confidential arrangements with people. People don't expect, even though they agree to be in a film, they don't expect their lives to be examined as if they agreed to be on a 24/7 live webcam. And I can tell you, this will have an incredibly chilling effect on me making these films in the future. And any journalist, if the next corporate whistleblower has to worry that an entire body of research of notes, of a filmmaker's notes, will be turned over to the adversary, people will clam up.
Michael Moore said something similar in the New York Times recently about a chilling effect. Your film includes several interviews with representatives of Chevron. Were they cooperative at the start?
It took a lot of work to get them to agree to be in the film. They were suspicious of me initially, and I, you know, said that my goal here is to present both sides, and that I would like their cooperation. And I still stand by that. I think the film is, ironically, the film actually has more. I did a count, and the film actually has more arguments in favor of Chevron in terms of the legal case than it does in favor of the plaintiffs.
Does the Judith Miller case have any impact on this? She was sent to jail for a time for refusing to give up her sources. In the end, Scooter Libby said that she could reveal his name. Is there anything like that that might apply here?
Well, unfortunately, that case sets a bad precedent for us. What I have been shocked to find out when I first got these papers, I thought there's no way that Chevron has any right to my footage. I have since learned that at the federal level, the journalist shield laws have been so chipped away at. One of the reasons I'm fighting this case is I want to raise the issue that we need better protection for journalists. But what's extraordinary about Judge Kaplan's decision is not the general idea that Chevron wants to look at our footage. If Chevron were to have had a much narrower request, if they were to say, hey, there's a scene in your film that shows some misconduct, we want to see the outtakes only of that scene, and here are the compelling reasons why. There is a lot of precedent for a judge to say, yes, that's okay. What's extraordinary here is that without showing relevance, without demonstrating that it's available from any other source, which is the measure of the journalist's privilege. You know, is it available from any other source? No. If the answer is no, and if it's highly relevant to the case, then yes, some limited access to a journalist's notes has been upheld by the court. But in this instance, and I can tell you, I don't want to specifically talk about the content of my outtakes because that would, again, that's the whole point of me fighting this battle, is that material is confidential. But I can say that well over half of my 600 hours of footage contains material that lots of people have filmed, including Chevron themselves. They had cameras rolling. So for a judge, and this is what every journalist should take note of, for a judge to say you can have access to 100% of everything this filmmaker ever shot on this case is going to set a horrible precedent for reporters in the future.
You're saying that basically what they're doing is a fishing expedition here.
They're rummaging through my underwear drawer, seeing if they can find something incriminating, and that we just can't allow that to happen. Again, if they were to narrow the scope, show relevance, show that I'm the only person with that information. I mean, look, it's a very complex issue. I happen to be involved in another film, the third film of this Paradise Lost series, which is about a wrongful conviction case where there's somebody on death row, Damien Echols. It's a story I've been following for 17 years. Mm-hmm. I'm on my third film about it. And if I knew that somebody, if I myself had information that would be exculpatory to allow a wrongly convicted person to get out of prison, of course I'd want that. I'd want somebody to be compelled to produce that. So, you know, it gets a little confusing here because there's an attitude towards big oil, and the request is pretty outrageous. But you have to be intellectually honest. There are times when a journalist should be compelled to turn over his footage if it means this person is the only one who has the info and it could help, you know, bring justice to a situation. But here, to turn over everything without showing relevance, without demonstrating that I'm the only source of it, is going to set a horrible precedent.
Just one more thing. If people want to see this film, is it available?
It is available. In fact, if you you can stream it on Netflix, which actually I get about a 25 cents per stream, and could I use the money now? This is costing me a fortune. Or you can buy it from First Run Features. We're also trying to raise money for this legal defense because it's costing us a fortune. And if people go to Kickstarter.com and do a search, Crude Fight for the First Amendment, there's a way of donating money in that way too.
Joe Berlinger's film, Crude, The Real Price of Oil, was about a legal battle that didn't involve him. Now he's involved in a legal battle of his own. Thank you so much for being on Underreported with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.